This episode's sponsored by Good Ranchers. Most people don't realize this, but over 85% of the grass-fed beef sold in the U.S. is actually imported from overseas. It's a system that often pushes out American farmers and ranchers. That's why it matters to be intentional about where you buy your meat. That's why I choose Good Ranchers. Good Ranchers connects you directly with local American farms and ranches. 100% American meat, pasture-raised, no antibiotics, no added hormones. Delivered straight to your door. Make the switch to better meat. Go to goodranchers.com to start your plan and get premium American meat delivered right to your door. That's goodranchers.com. American meat delivered.
The show is about to begin.
Hang in there, it is.
That's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
Featuring Smiley Kaufman.
If you were in a local IHOP at a PGA Tour event, you might see Hideki Matsuyama.
Put it up in the stance, strengthen the grip.
His co-host, Charlie Hume.
We've now picked five of the last eight winners on the PGA Tour.
Oh, it's going to hole. Please go in the hole. Please go in the hole. Please go in the hole.
Yes, sir.
And the biggest names in golf.
That's a great question. Can I talk about it?
I don't think I'm ready.
How good does it get, SK?
Why not ask, Charlie?
Today, live from the Pinecrest Inn, it's the Smiley Show. So long, everybody. This is the Smiley Show.
Welcome back to the Smiley Show, where Smiley, actually, I never really got to finish my vent on what was happening prior to the show, my equipment struggles. I don't think you really see it behind me, but effectively what happened was I had a bunch of ongoing HVAC issues. Thought I was going to have to replace the entire household thing when it had a great tech. Frank came out, did a little, tinkering, fixed it, right? But then I lost the HVAC, as was documented leading into Open Championship Week. I lost the unit right behind me. I was in here trying to record a show, and it was 91 degrees. That was very
British heat wave.
Classic British heat wave in Durham, North Carolina. It happens all the time. Durham, also a city in England. So, a little bit of sister city parallels there.
How about a little Birmingham, England, huh? While we're at it.
Yeah. Wow. I think that's amazing. We should go over and do shows in Durham and Birmingham in the UK.
It's like National Treasure, the Resolute Desk. Yeah. The sister desk is in Birmingham, England. We got one here in Birmingham, Alabama.
That? Hey, who said we weren't like a, geography pod? Geography pod, history pod, not a math pod, but might be one of those pods. So they came in here, and I was prepping for a tournament this week. So I got them all set up, and I went to go play. They replaced the new fancy HVAC system back there, all good to go, right? The unfortunate part of that was I had this green shelving here. I had this custom built by a very skilled carpenter to fit back there for this backdrop on our YouTube channel on television. And guess what happened when I tried to put that back in with the new footprint of the HVAC system? Does not fit. There's about this much room of space that I don't know what I'm going to do, Smiley. I do not know what I'm going to do. I don't know if I have the carpet.
You're telling me it used to look different than this?
No, you're seeing it like almost all the way pushed in, but not screwed in, not particularly sturdy. It's kind of like just sitting on the ledge there because there's like a large hose of some sort that's keeping it from going all the way in. So,
okay. All right.
Problems they abound, man.
That's a bummer.
What's new on your end? You played a little golf.
Week. Yeah. Oh,
that's
right.
You did get sick. Yeah.
And I don't know if I just got it coming back from the Open, having the kids, whatever it was.
It was a
mild one. And I actually asked ChatGPT whether I should play on Friday morning. I got the diagnosis of a mild flu of sorts, and the doc, the nurse said, hey, you probably shouldn't go and play golf, or you should just take it easy. But she doesn't know I hadn't played since the U.S. Open. I'm like, hey, I appreciate your interest in me and making sure that I try to stay healthy and get back to healthy. But there's no way I'm not playing tomorrow morning. You can't keep me off that golf course. I needed to get out there to see where I was at, to see what I needed to try out. What new swing thought were we going to discover out here the next morning? We didn't know until we get out there and go try it. But pretty quickly after that first hole, I was like, you know what? I probably should have just stayed at home. Mm. Did a little, like, little double chip from over the green. It's like, I don't got my hands.
Now, do you think this was a result of the sickness or like a medication you took for the sickness?
No,
was-
I just Bermuda rough and I just forgot how to chip. And I have been lazy about ordering a new 60 degree for a year and a half now and need to get on that. Got to get some grooves. So I just don't have any trust.
We know some good people in Cleveland.
I do. I know.
Make that happen. They're coming out with the RTZ2s this fall, like brand new metal, the classic Roger Cleveland 588 shape, all sorts of good stuff. So good reminder to us. I just didn't know.
Hit it well. I did hit
did
it well.
You really?
Yeah, I did hit it like
love that for you.
Real nice. I putted poorly on Saturday, chipped poorly on Friday. Like if I just got the ball up and down on Friday, made plenty enough birdies. But dude, my iron game on Saturday at times
love
was
that.
Like as good as it's been. And you know what my feel was?
What?
You know, I was like, I couldn't get enough of Sam Burns. So now I have Sam Burns and Scottie Scheffler morphed into my swing thoughts. And I do better when I like have a picture of somebody's swing in my head versus like trying to get to these technical positions. I'm almost like swinging to a visual of what I've seen from somebody. And I've watched Scottie play a ton of golf. I watched Sam play a ton of golf. And I kind of have like Sam's backswing going on. And then I'm trying Scottie's downswing. And what I mean by that, it's the stuff that Butch was talking about. Butch was like, you need to get that right ankle, or at least the left side of it working more this way versus like pushing down into my toe. So that's a Scottie move. That's what Scottie does. He pushes off the middle of his foot and is driving his pelvis into his left foot. And that's the break. And what I started to figure out was that I was more on top of the ball and I could actually feel that I could hold the face through and hit that fade. So like when I had a right to left breeze, which we had a ton of crosswinds this week on Friday and Saturday. And dude, I was holding these middle irons into right to left breezes, or even just like riding a left to right breeze with a fade with an iron. Like it was nothing. And you know, I've told you, I've struggled with a fade for the last 2 years. And here I come in my flu game, if you will. And I'm out here just hitting the Scottie fades out there. And now it wasn't perfect the whole week. I must admit it wasn't exactly like dialed, but for the shots that were good, it was really good.
I'll say this is, it's good. Our show golf performance is trending right now because the feel that Butch gave you about standing up a little taller, I've combined that with something I saw on Instagram. It's like one of those videos of Tiger Rory like talking. It's the one that keeps getting meme where it's like
it's the one
20 handicap
like,
buddy.
It's one of the strong face.
Love the strong face. So I got a really good like grip and like swing plane matchup right now that I'm hitting it really good. I had a psycho scorecard situation in the tournament on Saturday, but I did make four birdies. After like spending the entire week trying every putter I have in here and trying every different grip, we finally found something. So we're getting close. We're getting really close. I'm just happy that
hey, I'm happy about the four birdies. Nice.
Four birdies are great. Birdied our hardest hole in the course, four, and then 11 into the wind, and then almost aced 14. Little 9-iron there, just like really.
Ooh, that's the one that's just like kind of short right there before the par
only
five.
Short par three we have. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ah, see, look, this guy still got the Hope Valley photographic memory. Love that.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what.
It's kind of morphing between a golf course I played in Charlotte. So I kind of go back and forth between holes from there and Hope Valley. But for the most part, I remember most of y'all's scores.
All right, well, how's this for a segue? We're going to go from one Donald Ross golf course at Hope Valley to another one, Detroit Golf Club for the Rocket Classic.
Dude, it looked amazing, by the way.
I tell you what.
It's a shame. It's like all right when we get
I know, right when it gets good, we're leaving. What are we doing here? I'll say this, you know, on the course architecture front. So Tyler Ray, who kind of did the redesign, went on Five Clubs with Gary Williams last week to kind of prep us for the event. And he talked about, like, we've been on the show talking about Seminole and some of the changes they're doing to their green complexes, talked about the same sort of things where I love what's happening with all these Donald Ross courses where people are waking up and realize, hey, all those architects that came in the 60s and 70s and try to, like, you know, punch up the design, ruined it. They made it all reductive, all turtleback greens. Like, is that what he did at Pinehurst number two? Yes, it is. Is that what he did everywhere? Absolutely not. And so Tyler Ray comes in and does this, you know, careful historic restoration of these old school green shapes and adds all these really nice features. And of course, like you look at some of the like 361s out there this week, all went out in the morning wave with no wind. There was rain all week. It's soft. Like, yeah, those guys are going to shoot nothing. But I felt like coming down the stretch, bunch of guys in the mix today. It was windy. There were some kind of nervy shots where, you know, guy judged a wedge wrong or hit it on a tough spot. It created a ton of intrigues. Like, I'm just happy to see Donald Ross courses being taken back to true Donald Ross roots, not the reductive version of Donald Ross that many of us think about, false fronts, stuff like that.
Man, visually it looked awesome with the overhead drone shots. Remarkable. I always liked playing this golf course. It was one of my favorites, mainly because I could find my golf ball and hit it again. It's a pretty open ballpark when it comes to that. But now that it seemed like they had a little bit more strategery when it came to the fairway bunkers, you kind of had to avoid those off of the tee, where it kind of felt like they were in play, but you could kind of always just eliminate one side and then just kind of bomb it and go from there. But it's you know, the touch that I really like is the fescue on top of the bunkers.
Yeah,
that to me adds, it's a visual thing too, right? When you're in the fairway and you have tall grass that is, you know, taking up a little bit into the front of the green, it sometimes can just make you feel a little bit more claustrophobic about a shot, right? Coming into the greens. Mm-hmm. And I just like that as a feature. I think Southern Hills also mm-hmm. was another golf course that reminded me of that. They had that feature. So really like that. I thought the changes of the course were cool. You kind of said it too. The green complex is super unique in some of them, but lengthened. Actually, it wasn't lengthened. They just made it. They may have lengthened it. But par fives and par fours. And, you know, that back-to-back of 6-7, you know, 6 was always a pretty good, healthy par four. And then you go play 7, which now is a par four. Those are two pretty dang good test right there. And then 17 was always the most boring par five of all time. Now it was a par five or par four today where guys are hitting driver 7-iron. And I thought the first hole may have been the worst hole on the PGA Tour before they've renovated it. Now there's like a cross bunker that kind of comes out where guys are having to avoid that off the tee. But before, man, it was the easiest hole of all time. It was a driver that a golf ball couldn't end up anywhere other than just like whatever rough or fairway, and you had a 60-yard shot into the green. It was like, what? This is the easiest hole of all time to start. And so you always saw guys making two there throughout the week, and now it's a much better hard par four.
It's so interesting.
Better.
The point you make too about like the grasses and the visual nature of, you know, a course restoration, taking it back to its original roots, where I feel like some of the things that I find most intriguing on Ross courses, and a lot of this we've kind of dug into as we prepare for our own, you know, restoration next year, is that there are, of course, bunkers like the one you just mentioned, the cross bunker at 1, that PGA Tour pros actually have to think about and get a number on and figure out how they're going to avoid it, or you know, really kind of push it up on either side or play it short of that, things like that. But there are also so much of the bunkering that Ross did was just creating visual discomfort off mm-hmm. of tees and kind of trying to force you, not dissimilar to a lot of stuff that Alistair McKenzie did, but just like kind of forcing you into these uncomfortable feelings on the tee to really, you know, make it a more challenging shot, even if some of those bunkers or hazards didn't really come into play. And then I thought that, you know, for a lot of courses that did kind of get botched in their restoration or renovation efforts, you lost so much of the intrigue of the approach shot, because it boils down to short bad, center of the green good, long bad. Whereas instead, now you look at some of the hole locations at Detroit Golf Club today, or you know, the work that Gil Hans did down at Seminole, and it's like they have like 4 or 5 different really interesting hole locations. And you really standing over that approach shot thinking about, okay, you know, the wind's doing this, but like if I end up on the wrong side of this thing, I'll be lucky to 2-putt, like might mm-hmm. as well mark down a 3-putt. I think that is very, very cool. And it is cool to, you know, it's interesting. Later in the show, we're going to talk about the future of the PGA Tour and the destinations they're trying to go to. And, you know, we're losing this event, you know, at a classic Donald Ross course. We lost Sony. We're not going to see that anymore. Seth Rayner, of course. It kind of bums me out that you're losing these classics that have these really old school architectural feel. There's less and less on the PGA Tour these days.
You know, it kind of just made me start thinking about just golf courses in general, thinking about courses like the one we go in Houston, Memorial Park.
Yep.
Doesn't have hardly any bunkers out there. They pretty much have the whole design catered around it being a second shot golf course with the movement around the greens and the distance in which you're going to be playing into the greens, which is fairly long for the most part. And then you go to the other side of the coin of what we were just talking about with the Donna Ross course that, you know, you're standing on a tee and you know, the fairway may be 40 yards wide, but you're sitting on the tee and you're like, there might be like 7 yards of fairway that I feel like I'm looking at here.
Yes,
and there's not a wrong answer of which one is right, because I've played, you know, sometimes on golf courses, the best hole on the course is the hole that doesn't have a fairway bunker or a bunker on the hole in itself. You know, I grew up on a course where Jack Nicklaus's best hole was our fourth hole and there wasn't a bunker on the hole. And now it was tree line and we had a tornado roll through. And so things have changed out at that hole. But it just made me think about, you know, what I prefer in a golf hole. Mm-hmm. You know, there's especially in all these restorations and new designs that we're seeing and just what architects tend to prefer. And I'm not saying that, again, that there is a right or wrong answer, but I do like a mix of both. You know, I like, I hate feeling uncomfortable on the tee where I feel like I'm being squeezed, but I also love when architects are able to just do it with angles, right? If they're able to, you know, make you challenge up one side of the fairway to give yourself a better angle into a green that's more shallow or more diagonal versus more and more that has a run up area, you know, that's like another cool aspect of what I like in golf architecture too. It's like a good mix of both. I don't like to feel squeezed on every hole, but if you're able to like mix in a little bit of both, that's where I'm like, yeah, give me some of that.
Oh, I think for a lot of people, the test boils most simply down to like, if I leave this golf course, how many holes can I remember? You know, that kind of makes the course, how long is it going to stick in my brain? Did I like it? Did I not like it? And so I always feel like playing courses where there is your wheels are turning a lot over every shot. So we're talking about bunkers placement off of tees where you're really like, oh, like I know the angle of the hole. I should go over there, but that looks really,
right?
You need a yardage book too. But I think I just, in general, I make this much more simplified, you know, than it really is. But in general, it's like, if I'm thinking a lot before every shot, I'm really trying to feel like, you know, I can't just hit driver anywhere. And then like, yeah, this is kind of what you want to do on the green, but you're pretty safe everywhere. Like that course is going to exit my mind pretty quickly. Whereas like, the fact that I'm thinking about all these shots and the way I want to hit them, you leave and you're like, that course is seared into my memory just because I went through the process on each hole in such great depth and detail. So, yeah,
I feel like when I leave a golf course, and it's so often you hear somebody say, you know, if I just had one more round at this place, I'd be able to figure it out. I oftentimes think that when I say that about a place, like half the time I mean it, half the time I don't. The other half I'm thinking like, I don't think really it was that great of a golf course. There was too many things that I felt like were either funky up around the greens where it's landing in a spot that's like spined and you're getting a weird kick. And there would be just like features of the course that I felt like was just like not either fair or just wasn't keen to my eye to where it just was like, all right, if I hit a good shot, this is, you know, relatively like this is where it should end up. Versus like, you know, blind shots with dog legs. And, you know, that's sometimes a part of a golf course and you can't get around it. And that's fine. You get used to it the next time you play. But places that have just those humps and bumps in different places now, and I'm not talking about links golf, I'm talking about just US golf. Those are the places I tend to be like, not really in on what just happened on, you know, like 4 or 5 shots out there. You know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean, because I think there's a difference there. You have to split in your head between, do I need to see this place again because there was so much subtlety that I didn't fully appreciate? We're like, and this is the brilliance of architecture. It's like, if I hit a tee shot on a hole where you've disguised the trouble or the best approach angle, but I still am finding the ball, I'm just up there. I'm like, oh, got it. Like, this is the wrong angle. Like, I'm still in play. I can still make it, you know, versus you get up there and you're like, oh, wow, this fairway slopes at this insane aggressive angle and I'm in the water hazard now. And I thought I had like, I thought I was going to flip a wedge in. Now I'm dropping, hitting three. Like, the second category is I need to see this place again because there were so many silly design quirks that it just wasn't fair the first time. And I could shoot a course. I could shoot a good score, but I'd be going out there taking short irons off some tee, just doing stuff that's not really conducive to the true test of golf. I think that's the split.
Okay, all right. I'm gonna give my answer here, and I'm gonna let you think of yours. But what is your least favorite design? Not least favorite design, but least favorite design feature, if you will.
Okay.
And so, what I mean by that, my answer is I can't stand a creek or a patch of rough that runs across the fairway and separates a fairway within two. I think it's one that annoys me the most, where I'm having to shoot and I'm like, okay, it's a 300 cover over this fairway, or at least over this creek to get into this fairway. I either have to lay up short or I've got to cover this. I can't stand it. It's my least favorite design feature.
It's so funny you say this because keep going back to Hope Valley, but Hope Valley used to have a creek cut across on the 11th hole. And Ben Hogan came and played there for some. So there's like a Durham Open there for a while. Like this is where Byron Nelson won his fourth, 11th events in a row at the Durham Open at Hope Valley. So Hogan was out there and said, this is my favorite hole out here. And he came back a couple years later and they'd taken the creek out. And he's like, you guys just ruined the best hole in your golf course. Like, I'm never playing here again. so they're bringing back that creek when they do the restoration next year. But I think that's a good shout.
I don't know.
I think it's hard for me to place, a specific like gimmicky design feature. I do. There have been some courses I've gone to. I think mine boils down to green complexes where there is a way to use slope and speed correctly to where you can make it difficult, but you give me an option as to like both what I'm trying to do on an approach shot, where it's like, okay, if I hit it here, even if it looks like that's safe, if I'm trying to go to pin, I'm actually going to end up in a bad spot. But if you kind of use this slope over here, there's a backstop behind it. Like I can still get to that pin where there's some greens where it's like, this is like putt-putt. Like, go ahead and just put a clown's mouth out here. Like, what are we doing? And I know that as new architects especially, you're trying to create a design or a hole that stands out. Everyone remembers the big Himalayas hole putting green. I think it's cartoonish and stupid.
Me and you both, we're on the same page. I don't like double breaking greens. Yeah. Now, I can deal with it if it's, a couple times at a round and if it's, much more subtle in its usage. But my other one that has to deal with slope. So if that was 1A with a cross bunker is fine, but really a cross creek is what I'm kind of referring to. My 1B would be tee boxes that are designed to have slope in them. So if it's not a flat tee box, like I can understand it just being like, a half a degree off here or there one way. Like that's not going to be the end of the world. But when you literally feel like you're on an upslope or the ball's above your feet or below your feet, and even throwing that in there, I see it all the time in golf courses where they will purposely aim the tee box away from where they want you to aim it. It's like, let's just put it straight,
Yeah.
Let's just put it straight.
So you're talking about aiming in addition to elevation?
I would say that's pretty far. I pick up on those things, but a lot of people don't. And so they end up aiming it where the tee box is aiming them, and they end up hitting it, right where the tee box wanted them to go. And that's something I'll notice, but a lot of people don't. But the slope thing is a bit frustrating at times for me. Now, you could deal with it. These are like very ticky-tack things, but we're talking about design features, which is a very ticky-tack annoying thing to talk about anyways.
Well, and I agree because I feel like if you're aiming a tee box – like you should aim the tee box for the straightest and most conservative line. Like basically you should say to yourself, if you're an architect, if I'm playing for like the 250 to 260 yard hitter off the tee, if I was telling them hit a straight shot safe, this is where I'd aim this thing. Because then I think what it does is if you're trying to cut the corner or you're trying to kind of do something, then you have to take it upon yourself to change your aim in a way that feels uncomfortable. And that's part of what you're doing. Instead of going up there and you're like, wait, is there actually, especially if you're playing a course for the first time, like, wait, should I be aimed over there? Like, there's something I don't know about? And then you hit it up there. It's like, no, guess what? you're on the hazard, your bone. You're like, well, that felt very unfair. I no longer like this golf course.
Yeah. All right. So that's kind of our soapbox on that.
Yes, but one last
question though. Do you like when your caddy just gives you a number and like first, like doesn't give you like an adjusted number? And it just says, hey, it's 146 there. You didn't see him shoot or anything. You just kind of looked at that sprinkler head. Like it's tough, right?
Because
like,
it's
you
tough.
Know, they're really good at their job and like they've been doing it for a long time. Cause a lot of time when I'm talking about like, you're at a really, really nice golf course, but you know, sometimes I'm like, man, I just hit that 155 and I just flew like 40 feet long.
So
can I just shoot it? You know,
so
but you don't want to be an a-hole.
That's right. You're trying to be respectful. It's so funny because I just had this conversation this weekend with my partner Trey. It's like you randomly get partnered up, and I never played with him in a tournament before, and we both have the same like psychotic quality of talking out loud through every single shot and like going through. And so we're looking at each other like the fourth row, like this is amazing. Like he's got the green book out, like doing
which
slow.
I like.
I love that. And so we were speaking the same language, but then we started talking about going certain places and you get caddies and you never want to be disrespectful to a place where the caddy master is taking time to bring in the people they like, training people. But there is this sort of feeling out process of your caddy where I'll tell you what the one I hate the most is caddy choosing a club for me before you've even had a conversation about it. Hey, just send you up to the tee box with driver. Just hit driver. You're like, dude. You don't know.
Oh, I'm fine with that. I'm fine with the clubs off the tee, like because you're kind of just getting their advice off that. Like,
he doesn't know how long my carry is. He doesn't know what my shot shape is. Like, especially right out of the gate. What I'd like for him to tell me is, and you and I, when we went out and played spyglass, like, hey, what's the yardage to like all the way through the fairway on that line? Like, what's the yardage over here? Just give me numbers, and then I will do the math and figure out what club I need to hit. And then as we get through the round, then you know you're six holes in, you've hit a couple of good
sample size.
And you know, you got a tweener yardage between an 8-iron and a 7-iron. He's like, why don't you go ahead and step on the 8 today? Cause you've hit a bunch of good 8-irons. And then you're like, great. You're trying to give me some confidence. Like, but the ones where they're just basing you off of standard numbers and stats, like, yeah, just hit driver here. It's like, that's not enough information for me. That might be a me problem though.
I think that is a you problem there. Cause for the most time, I'm always just going to grab driver for the most part. If they say they like something, I'm already so wired into not wanting to hit a 3-wood that I'm going to try to squeeze a driver wherever I possibly can, unless there's a cross creek that I have to deal with. And then from there, I'm already like in really trouble because I hate cross creeks, which we have documented.
Yes.
But it's the clubbing a little bit at times, you know, they would have no idea what, you know, how far I hit something, what type of shots I hit. So when I hear it's like, hey, it's a 7-iron here, it's like, all right, hold on. I didn't even thought through the shot yet. I don't even know what trajectory, how far I want to land this thing. And first off, we don't even know if the number I just was told, if that's the adjusted number or not. So like, I'm like kind of like still working on the math in my head. Now, a lot of people don't care. They're like, yeah, dude, I'll hit a 7-iron. Cool. I'm out here playing golf. I'm drinking beer, having a good time. And I wish I could do that more often.
Yeah.
But, and sometimes I get to that point in the round where if I've made, you know, enough bogeys in a row, it's like, all right, today's done. You know, we're not shooting anything worth of value. So let's, you know what? It is just a 7-iron. Then who cares where it goes?
Well, look, if you showed up here tonight, hoping for 25 minutes of just general musings on course design and caddying and things we like and don't like, hope you enjoyed that last segment of the show. If you showed up,
wait, who won the Rocket Classic?
All right, Smiley, remaining true and steadfast to the Smiley Show traditions we've developed here, we just sort of start recording, and wherever it takes us, it takes us. And as a result of that, we got to the end of this episode and realized, you know what, we probably should have teed up the Stephen Sweeney piece a lot earlier, especially after we, and actually, I don't know where this is going to land, because you either just listened to 30 minutes of golf course architecture talk, or you're about to get that. But in either situation, what you're about to hear right now is a conversation that Smiley and then I joined at the end had with Michael Thorbjornsen's putting coach, Stephen Sweeney. He is a dear friend of the show. We went down to his high-tech putting studio in Florida and did sort of an instructional piece you should go check out right now if you haven't on YouTube. Might help you if you're a sicko putter tinkerer like me. But just some really cool insight on the path they've taken together, Smiley, to earn this first PGA Tour win.
No, it's 100%. Sweeney's great. He's one good. Of the good ones. You know, you got, you know, I think in any industry, you know, there's coaches or, you know, people that have egos and come across as know-it-alls. He's not one of those guys. He is one of the most chill, easy to guys to talk to with no ego. And it's, you know, it's been great to get to know him and really, really happy that he's, you know, part of Thor's team. Thor gets the dub. So it's a team win. And I was a little disappointed he didn't have a Guinness, but I don't want to spoil the interview. So might as well get into it, huh?
He is a great guy to have a Guinness with if we're in the setting in which that is appropriate context. So, without further ado, we're just going to get you right to that conversation. And then you're just going to exit the tunnel on the other side. You're going to be back into some piece of content that I don't know where it's going to land yet. And we hope you enjoyed that when that happened.
Well, one of the best young players on the PGA Tour finally has broke through, Michael Thorbjørnsen, one of the most recent PGA Tour winners. So, of course, we had to have Stephen Sweeney, the putting coach of Michael, come on today. Stephen, how excited were you to see that golf ball going on the 18th hole? It was the longest putt he made the entire week, 25.8 inches. I mean, come on, how good was that?
Yeah, no, it was pretty awesome. I was actually at the Wyndham Championship working with Aaron Wise today and just nervously kind of checking my phone and just got into my hotel room, checked in, turned on the TV, and right as I turned it on, he made the putt. So it was awesome.
Yeah. So you never had to sweat it out. Like, you weren't even looking at your phone while you're working with Aaron. You're nothing but all business at the Wyndham Championship, getting the next guys ready.
I broke a lot of traffic laws coming home looking at my PGA Tour app live updating on the way home.
rightfully so, man. Well, first off, congratulations. That's a heck of an achievement. I mean, this kid, it's, you know, we got a lot of young winners right now on the PGA Tour. Everybody was talking about Jackson Kuiven coming into this week. Michael Thorbjørnsen was a player who we documented coming into this season. He's another PGA Tour U guy. Tons of talent coming out of Stanford's, had plenty of success on the PGA Tour. Coming into the year, Steven, I said, if this guy can just round out his game around the greens, really, I mean, really the sky's the limit for Michael. Is that, you know, when he steps in, a guy like that steps into your office, that's the exact type of player you want to come in because you know he's going to be so solid from tee to green.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was so excited when I first found out that I was going to have a chance to work with him. Going back to the Travelers 2 years ago when he got his PGA Tour U card, you know, they gave him an invite into that Elevated event. And, you know, meeting up with him there for the first time and then all the way, like, you know, through to today to see obviously him win and just what it meant to him and, you know, his family and, you know, his dad's been heavily involved for such a long time. It's really cool to be able to watch that happen.
Well, he's got a lot of unique stuff about his action, right? Like his golf swing it's very, very good. He hits it very far, hits it straight, hits a lot of greens, but he's got a 10 finger grip. And I know we're not here to talk about his full swing, but he does it kind of in his own way, which I think, when a student like that shows up into your office, that's kind of nice that you know that he's got some creativity and at least in the way he plays the game.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, you know, with the amount of players that I coach, I mean, you see me out there week to week. It's tough to get on the golf course to see them live in action. And, you know, I'd worked with them for a while and eventually at the PGA Championship at Quail Hollow, I got out to see him. And the first shot I didn't even see him hit was on 17 on the par three. And he was playing with another really top young player who everyone would know, but you know, the other guy hits first. I was grabbing a water out of the cooler and Michael hit, and it was the third person that's ever made me do this. I literally like turned around immediately, like the sound off the club. You know, it was just different. And you know, as a putting guy, like, you I don't get that excited about full game stuff, but yeah. It was one of those, like, you immediately turn around, I was like, what was that? That was not normal, you know? So he's got just an immense amount of talent and it's so good to see him finally get it over the line.
All right. So what's in Michael's DNA when it comes to just his overall short game? Like when he shows up, you know, in your office or the first time into your studio, you know, what were his beliefs in putting and what did you see in his just overall DNA? And did any of it have any translation between how he swung the golf club or how he set up to the golf ball and kind of what was in his putting stroke?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you've been to my studio, Smiley. You've sort of seen how I do things, and you sort of seen behind the curtain a little bit. But you know, because he's got so much natural talent, I think he was kind of winging it a lot with his putting, as far as just, you know, I'll try this or I'll try that. And when I first met him, he was cross-handed, and you know, that was something that, like, it was part of his DNA by that point. Obviously, he was the best player at Stanford, won PGA Tour U. But, you know, it wasn't a case of there was any reason why he did things. There was no real baseline around, A, how he practiced, or B, what he was kind of working on from a week-to-week kind of point of view. So very raw, but obviously super talented. So the main things that we really tried to do were just to instill good baselines, and, you know, give him some drills that he could work off statistically with strokes gained in mind and stuff like that. And, you know, the one thing I will say to his credit, the first probably couple of months, you know, it was a little learning curve for both of us, but, you know, he really showed an ability to become a great short putter. And, you know, with as good as he hits the golf ball, essentially the big thing was to try and be a little bit more consistent with his speed. And then on top of that, you know, just trying to capitalize a little bit more on some of these mid-range birdie efforts that you need to win tournaments. Cause you know, you obviously got to make a lot of birdies out there now.
Now, when you look at a guy like Michael, you know, Michael Thorbjornsson is a player who's led the greens in regulation stat last year on the PGA Tour. This year, he's up there as well. When you think about how you coach a player like Michael, who's maybe a little bit similar to, you know, a Scottie Scheffler, right? This is a guy who's going to be in a lot of fairways, a lot of greens, and necessarily when Michael goes and looks at his putting statistics, he may get frustrated being like, you know what? I feel like I'm a better putter than 115th in the strokes game data. But is it working against him a little bit that he's got so many more looks of outside 20 feet, give or take, because he hits so many greens in regulation? Is that tough on you as a coach sometimes?
I think, yes and no. You know, we obviously were excited to kind of scrub the stats and go into this season pretty fresh and sort of get a, you know, we'd done a good body of work over the winter and sort of see where can we get to stats wise. And then, you know, he came off a great week in Phoenix, went to Pebble, pretty tired. And he just had a really, really bad week on the greens in Pebble.
Hey, not the first guy.
He's not the first guy at all.
I never taught those greens well.
To the point that he basically ruined his season's stats with just like one like crazy bad week. So that was a little bit unfortunate for his stats. And you know, we've talked about it. Like, he's putted much better than his stats would suggest that he's putted, based on the fact that, you know, he then followed it up with another bad week at the PGA at up there in Philadelphia at Aronimink,
which was another tough week. Guys were like, that statistically weren't making as many putts inside of 10 feet. So there's exactly 2 weeks that you can kind of just throw out the trash as, you know, unusual weeks that these guys don't typically face. Not giving an excuse, but it's also something that was well documented that week in particular.
Exactly. So he, you know, I mean, I think for good players, you always know when you're putting good and when you're putting bad, regardless of what the stats say. And he's been putting good for a long time. And, you know, you just have these anomalies that kind of statistically, you know, kind of blot your scorecard a little bit. But, you know, the short putting has been phenomenal. He's really done well there. And the speed, we've done a lot of work on trying to trying to negate like the three putts, and then mm-hmm. you know, just like you said, because he gives himself so many looks, or you know, day in day out, it's hard to convert them from that distance, especially when you're dealing with so much slope from 20 feet all the time, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes total sense, and I can understand why you guys would target speed, because it's not easy percentage wise to make putts outside of 10 feet, give or take. Also, commend you guys. Looked at the stats, 4 to 8 feet range, much improved in 2026. So, to your point, has made drastic improvements there. So, Charlie, let's bring those videos up. Before we got on here, me, you, and Steven are talking, and I say you, I'm referring to Charlie as we're looking at this video. Michael, he said before, after this week in particular, there was a bit of a come to Jesus moment between Michael and Steven because of what you saw in his putting this week in particular. What are we looking at, and what did you see, and what did you guys have to go and change?
Yeah, so this was coming off the back of Pebble Beach, and obviously, you know, he had not felt good there. And he, you know, he was kind of fighting me a little bit. He's like, yeah, I want to try this. And he was going to stand, you know, super open. And I brought this little thing from my studio just up the street, where I was just trying to get him to move the putter pretty clean on online. Mm-hmm. But obviously his baseline there, you know, you can see with his lower body's just so wide open to the left. And
yeah,
then
I see that, man.
When we looked at his face on, it was causing him problems as well with where his ball position was relative to his feet. So yeah, because he turned his feet and his whole lower body so far to the left, effectively mm-hmm. his ball position relative to his forward feet had gotten way, way, way back and in.
Oh, it's gotten back. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Look at that. So, I can see that.
So this was at Palm Beach, at the Cognizant. Yeah.
Doesn't look happy in that putt either. he's already mad on the putting green. That's when you know he's a guy that's frustrated with his game at the time.
Yeah, so I mean, we come off this week, and you know, it wasn't a brilliant week on the greens. Obviously, Pebble, he'd struggled, and you know, JJ, his caddy, and myself, we've had a pretty long relationship now. You know, we both had worked together with Colin Morikawa.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like I've had a lot of support and confidence from JJ over the years. And mm-hmm. when we got to Bay Hill then the following week, you know, he was in an elevated event, but I was like, look, dude, do you want to look like the best putter in the world? First of all, you don't look like a good putter. And second of all, you know, I think there just needs to be some changes that are really going to help you long term. And one of the things he really struggled with when he stood like this was he would hit it off the heel a lot.
Mm-hmm. Would he draws the golf?
Yeah, big time. So, you know, he draws the golf ball. So a lot of the draw components in his golf swing, the path was working super, super in and out, the ball's back in a stance, like mm-hmm. kind that of things sense. You'd want to see for a draw.
Yeah.
you know, the ball kind of starting right off his baseline from his feet. So
yeah,
these were the things that I just didn't like seeing from him. And we got a chance to go into my putting studio as well and baseline some numbers. So we just went back to like real basics, and I said to him, I was like, look, if you were going to teach a 5-year-old how to putt, how would you explain it to them? And, you know, he was like, well, if they were standing on train tracks and the ball and the putter was on one train track and my feet were on the other train track, and then you just basically move your shoulders and the putter goes back and through and the ball starts down that line. So you can see here we worked on getting the shaft lined up with that shaft on the ground, yeah, with that stick on the ground. Mm-hmm.
The ball position Balls looks better too. Yeah.
Way more forward, yeah. Mm-hmm. He was able to stay in the putt a lot easier. He wasn't sort of backing up and out of it because of his ball position being so far back as well. And you know, the first thing he said after we took these two videos was like, oh, I actually look like a good putter in these videos.
Hey, that was something you were trying to get him to at least visually look like that he knew what he was doing. And I could see it here, man. Like when you have an open stance and the ball back, there's not a whole lot of good that can come from that. You might have one hot putting round, but over the course of a season, putting on different grasses, different speeds, having to adjust with wind day in and day out, you got no chance to be a good putter out there. At least one of the better putters on the PGA Tour get to the level that he wants to get to.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously you can see it from this angle massively where, you know, his knees, his feet, everything have lined up way better. He's hitting it way more out of the center of the putter. And, you know, it actually cleaned up a lot of his speed as well because he started hitting the ball way more out of the center of the face. Mm-hmm. And weirdly, these were changes that we made the week of Phoenix when he almost won. And then, you know, with Pebble being the week after, it had worked for 1 week. Then obviously it went bad. And then by Cognizant, he was like, I'm just going to try something.
Yeah.
And this was sort of JJ, you know, really being a massive help as a caddy, getting into it with him and saying, look, this worked. Like, don't give up on it so quickly. Let's get back to this. And, you know, the difference is obviously pretty apparent from the eye, you know?
No, it looks really good here. And it's looked really nice throughout the entire season that I've had opportunities to watch him. And Charlie's going to come in here and kind of finish up this interview. But before we get there, I just have to ask you, you know, I kind of briefly touched on it just about what his ceiling might be. And I go and look at his statistics and see that he's, you know, had 8 top fives and he's only 24 years old. He's a PGA Tour U guy coming out, gets his card that way. He's an elite driver, hits a bunch of greens, his short game's rapidly improving. What is the ceiling for this guy, Michael?
It's as high as he wants it to be. You know, it's one of those kids you look at and you just think, well, like you can do anything you want. You know, we had a funny situation the last couple of years where he got into Philly Cricket Club last year and I was like, I'll see you at Quail Hollow next week. And he was like, sure, okay. And he kept his end of the bargain. And this year at the Scottish Open, he wasn't in the Open. I was like, I'll see you at Birkdale next week. And he was like, oh, yeah, okay, sure. And I was like, no. This is a deal. We made the deal last year. I'll see you at the Open next week. And then, you know, he finished second and got down to the Open or the third, whatever it was. And when the pressure's been on, he's delivered. And, you know, I feel like getting this win is really just going to sort of break that glass ceiling mm-hmm. for him and let him just do whatever he wants from here.
It was a team win, Charlie. I mean, how about it? We should have had some Guinness on here, right?
We talked to Shane Lowry about the best Guinness in the world very recently, but this is a very full circle moment for this show and for Stephen Sweeney, because if you think back, to the last piece of content featuring Stephen Sweeney that we distributed on our YouTube channel, a fantastic putting lesson that everyone should go and check out. You know, did some work with Smiley, did some work with the 5-year-old that Michael Thorbjornsson was talking to, me, in the second half of that video. But there's so much good in there. And as we were walking into that studio to film that project, who was in there for, I guess, one of the first times ever, Stephen? Michael Thorbjornsson. So here we are. However many years later, he's a winner on tour, a ton of potential talent. What I want to talk to you about, Stephen, is this sort of new venture you've gotten into. In addition to your putting instructor jobs, you're rivaling Smiley for how can I collect the most amount of jobs possible. So you're in our, you know, little swimming pool, so to speak. Now you're doing content for golf.com. And I if you could just talk about, you know, where this idea came from, the type of content you're going to serve, where people can go and find it, because this is so funny. Like a night ago, before we knew that Thor was going to win, before we knew you're going to come on the show, I'm texting you. I'm like, hey, do you guys, I can add an inch to my putter and I don't know if it's too long or not. And you're like, just send me some videos. And you're speaking to a lot of Charlies out there that like are putter tinkerers. We have a sickness and there's a lot you can learn and gain from the stuff you're doing for golf.com.
Just for the record, Smiley, he suggested that he was going to weld an inch onto his putter.
See what I'm working with here, Steven?
I got a problem. I got a problem, and I'm willing to admit it. I just don't know. I know how to fix it. It's a problem.
So you come by the tour truck this week with one of, with your putter, and I'll show you. It's not as hard to get your putter lengthened as having to weld it. I promise you, it's not that difficult.
Okay. Looks like I'm going to Sedgefield. All right. See you soon.
But no, there. You know, I had 19 unbelievable years at Odyssey. Like, just like the best time with Callaway, with Odyssey, and you know, I have some friends over at 8 AM and golf.com, and Johnny Wonder had just gone over there from Callaway, and they had this real gap where they weren't able to sort of cover the putter industry as well as they wanted. And we started talking, and I felt like I'd kind of done everything I wanted to do at Odyssey. You know, I'd gone in there from just a regular kind of ambassador to being involved in R&D and launching product and stuff like that. And it was a super cool journey, but it kind of handcuffed me to only be able to work with Odyssey. And now since then, with golf.com, being able to work with guys like James Hawley over at TaylorMade, and, you know, Drew and Brad at Scotty Cameron, and just, and still the guys at Odyssey, and all these guys, you know, Ping and everything. It's been so, so refreshing to just sort of be able to test the waters with everything. And honestly, for myself, like, just the first 6 months of this year, I went down so many rabbit holes on testing putters where, you know, testing Scotties and TaylorMades and Pings and everything. Just, it's been a lot of fun.
We don't have enough time to be able to get into all of those questions just popped in Charlie's head, because I know he just had about 42 that was like, wait, did you try that one? Or what this about is, that prototype?
I tell you what, I'll pledge this to you, Smiley. If I should be able to make some time. If I get down to see Sweeney this week, I'll have someone film me just dumping my brain's contents onto Steven and what we end up doing with the putter. Maybe that'll be like a little bonus feature for our socials.
Just to defend the Irish, I am celebrating with a Starbucks, not a Guinness.
Oh, man.
All right. Yeah. That's usually, it can be us from time to time late at night. You put the kids down, need a little jolt of caffeine. I can't let you leave, Sweeney, without, in addition to putting instructor of the best players on tour, in addition to now creating putting focused content for golf.com, also a budding YouTube content creator, star personality, and the People's League. I believe I have this right. It's yourself. It's Johnny Wonder. And then it's your boy, who I got to play with on the West Coast. We all three of us got to play, Robbie Fox, who, this man's a whole vibe, Smiley. Like, we're talking about Oakley wraparound shades, like some really interesting alignment techniques, but a fantastic player. And the three of you debuted in this People's League recently. So just more content. Like, just to get the, you know, different sides of Steven Sweeney out there on the internet of golf. I love it.
Yeah, we founded this team. We were able to buy a team in the People's League, Foxy and myself, and we needed, you know, three players. So
tell Robbie, by the way, really good of him to name the team after himself. That was great move.
It wasn't all him, to be honest, but, you know, we tried to get Smiley Kaufman, but he wasn't available. So Johnny Wonder was next up.
Oh, man.
But I will give you an exclusive. We actually just did sign our fourth player. He's got 2.5 million YouTube followers. Nico Leonard Vanderhorst. He is the ultimate watch guru on the internet. So he's coming to play for us. And we're currently recruiting a female player as well. So it's a fun time. It is not what I'm an expert at. I'm trying to learn how to be a YouTube golfer as I go. So we'll see how that goes.
If they have another franchise available, I'll just spend some of Smiley's money on that. We'll just get us a team. We'll pop in there as well.
Oh, man. Golly. Steven, every time we hop on and chat it up, or we get lessons with you, we always have a great time, man. We appreciate you taking the time, and huge congrats, man. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I didn't hit any shots or give any yardages. So congrats to the boys. And, just, I'm so stoked for what's to come for Michael.
Yeah.
I tell you what, yeah. I bet he feels the exact same way for you watching you be a YouTube golfer now. One day y'all are going to have to celebrate a team win with your team getting a dub. So, hey, it goes both ways, Steven.
Yeah, put in a note for us. See if we can have Thor come on and break down your highlights on social. From
oh, P5. My God. We didn't Nobody needs to see that. Nobody needs to see that whatsoever.
All right, well, congrats, Steven, and see you in Greensboro.
All right, we'll see you there.
Talk soon.
See you, Steven. Guys. Thanks, bye.
Well, here's what I'll tell you is, like, first of all, this is when we started the year, and we do this. It's like a great show tradition we develop where we have on James and Eddie's. He gives us all the Corn Ferry Tour grads he likes. Obviously, Thor was not a Corn Ferry Tour grad, but I'm saying more so in the process of us kind of setting up the year. Like, we're trying to figure out guys we like the year before. We've been kind of trending, see about the new guys. And then you put together your list of like 9 guys you liked, and Thor was on this list. And, you know, he obviously had a close call at the Phoenix Open. I really think the coolest part of this episode for all who are watching or listening is scroll ahead to, I don't know if this you're watching the full context of this on Golf Channel or if we've broken this up into segments on YouTube, but the conversation we just recorded with Steven Sweeney, Michael Thorbjørnsen's putting coach, thinks a really, really cool one about the way they, I mean, obviously guy stripes the ball, hits it a mile, but fine tuning that piece of it. You saw it with the 26 footer he made on 18 today to put this thing on ice. So we'll unpack that a little further, but I think Smiley, just your overall thoughts on Thor's maybe career path to this point, his first PGA Tour win. And honestly, one of the things I thought about in the immediate aftermath of this win is, remember maybe it was last week, the week before, we're talking about this part of the schedule, the post Open Championship part of the schedule. You know, the John Deere's, the Rockets, the 3Ms, where this is where, you know, a couple years ago, Davis Thompson and Thorbjørnsen and a number of others are doing down the stretch. Like, this is a cool time of the year to have storylines like this. You have back-to-back winners on the PGA Tour that both came from PGA Tour U, and I hope we don't lose that when we have a stratified tour in 2028.
Man, Michael plays good this time of the year. You know, he's got that John Deere, you know, played good at the Scottish Open this year, won the Western Am back in 2022, I think it was. So we're archives. You know, some guys play well at certain times of the year. And here Michael Thorbjørnsen is winning for the winning on the PGA Tour on a golf course that played hard today on Sunday. And it was not necessarily quite as of a cupcake as it was early in the week. Thorbjørnsen had his best round of the week on Sunday, the lowest round of the day, shooting a 63, no bogeys. Of course, kind of sealing it off with that 25-footer, which was the longest putt he made the entire week. He actually had only made 12 putts outside of 25 feet the entire year. And so just for him to make a putt from that link to seal it, especially with, you know, the situation at the time, if Michael goes in 3 putts, Xander Schauffele had a chance to make his putt to tie him. And Xander, of course, made his putt. So it was, for a second there, like, there was a chance for a 2-shot swing if Michael hit a poor putt. But really going into that back nine, it felt like it was anybody's ball game. There was a lot of guys that had a chance. Davis Riley was the guy who was out in front today. Michael Brennan was a player that seemed to felt like it was going to be a guy that was going to have a good Sunday, didn't have his best day. But, you know, Michael was – he was rock solid, man. He hit 17 greens on a gusty day. It's wet outside. When you have – I always found those to be the most challenging days almost when it's soft and it's gusty winds from the north that are inconsistent. Those are the most challenging days because of the strength of the wind could change dramatically, especially when you get that north heavier air and the ball just feels like on crosswinds, doesn't want to stay on line. Saw it a couple different times, especially on the longer par fours today. But Michael handled it beautifully, only hitting 17 greens, only missing 9 greens on the week. And Charlie, that's kind of been his bread and butter, man, is that he's unorthodox as it is, being a 10-finger guy, he's an elite ball striker.
Yeah, you talked to Steven about his sort of unique background, the creativity and the way he's gone about forming his game, that 10-finger grip on full shots, you know, putting grip, setup, all those sorts of things. So for a deeper dive on that, we'll let that live later in the show. You mentioned Xander Schauffele, his best finish of the year to date. Good, nice him trending after this sort of, I don't want to call it like a long bounce back, but, you know, really, if we think back to his 2024 year where he wins 2 majors, and then he's injured to begin 2025, It's been maybe some near misses for him, and maybe not his the best version of Xander Schauffele's game, at least not living up to that 2024 standard. I think the place to maybe fast forward this a little is looking ahead to this regular season finale next week at the Wyndham and looking to where we stand. And really, I think three sort of main categories, Smiley, some notable names that are outside the top 100 and then outside the top 70 and the outside the top 50. And I think that they're notable in two different cases, right? They're, of course, in the context of the season that will end in a regular sense after next week, but also will extend into the fall for guys that are trying to finish top 100 or better and retain their full 2027 PGA Tour status, you know, going forward. But I also think it's interesting, especially with these names I'm going to mention right now, to think about not knowing how the fall is going to get reconfigured under the new 2028 Championship Tour, Challengers Tour, and if there is a cutoff, that these guys I'm going to note here could end up being a group of players you'd see on that Challengers Tour after the Wyndham Championship. So I'll start with Rasmus Højgaard, who's currently 103rd. Michael Brennan, 105th, which is, man, it's tough. Like, your driver's seat, you win, obviously. I mean, you know,
both of those guys, man, were in good position. Like, they were two guys that could have won today. It could have changed their, you know, the outlook of what their, you know, FedEx Cup ranking potentially could be. Now they're, you know, on the outside looking in, like you're talking about.
Davis Riley as well, 108th. I mean, Thorbjørnsen jumped from 69th to 38th with the win. Billy Horschel, 107th. Marco Pinge, 109th. Joel Damon at 119th. Pains me to read Hao Tong Li at 129th. Please do not take him from us. I need him to keep his guard. Luke Glenn at 147th. Garrick Higo, 163rd. Nick Dunlap, 165th. And Neil Shipley and 184th. I know it's kind of cherry-picked, but I mean, I'm looking at that as like guys that, you know, hey, play well this next week, play well in the fall and get inside top 100. But also, you know, if that is Challengers Tour in 2028, there are a lot of guys that I care about going and watching on off weeks.
No, 100%. And just to, you know, not to pick on a couple of the guys, but I think like Luke Clanton probably surprises me the most. I felt like he was going to be a guy that at worst was going to be, you know, in that 70 to 100 range if he had a bad year. Really surprised to see that he's 147th on the FedEx Cup. Felt like his game was suited for the PGA Tour right away out of college. So, you know, maybe this fall will be where, you know, it finally kind of clicks for him. Would not be surprised if he won this fall, which would, you know, catapult him most likely inside that top 100, keeping his tour card. So that's a fun storyline to follow. Neil Shipley is a pretty big shock. I know his putter was always something that was a big weakness for him. And now it's definitely been exposed on the PGA Tour. Ball striking's actually been really good this year, but the putter's been really, really poor. So look for him to make changes there. And yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of guys that I see on this list, man. Like even Chris Kirk's 127. This guy's been on tour.
Another guy forever. Had a chance this week, right? Like,
yeah, another guy. There was a ton of storylines. And so heading into the Wyndham next week, you know, we're going to see plenty of guys that, you know, look good for a long time, but man, when you start making a couple bogeys, you drop from that second to the fifth to the sixth, and all of a sudden those points really start to dwindle. But outside that top 100, it's something that's much more interesting, you know, by the end of the year, but it's really top 70 is what we're looking at after the Wyndham.
And so that leads to the next group of names I'll read you, which are, you know, 71 to 100 right now, would retain their tour cards for 2027, but would not make the 2026 FedEx Cup playoffs.
They would
not play well next week at the Wyndham Championship. So Lucas Glover at 96th, Tony Finau at 89th, Brooks Koepka at 86th, Jason Day at 75th, and Keegan Bradley at 72nd are the names that kind of popped the most for me.
Yeah, Keegan, definitely. And then Tony Finau, I guess the last 2 years now. It's a bit of a trend, man. Like, it's, you know,
wasn't in the majors really this year for the most part, right?
He's not hitting it as far. His iron game isn't as good as it was, which it was elite there for quite a number of years. And just, you know, he was a guy that dominated the par fives. Not to say that he still isn't. I'm not sitting here looking at the stat sheet, but it feels like he just doesn't have the pop in the bat. And then the putter's been inconsistent. You know, it just hasn't been a, you know, something that gets hot or streaky. It's been something that's just been kind of babysat, it feels like.
Yeah, I just want to confirm, but yeah, did not play in a single major in 2026. And you know what's interesting on that one too is, like, I saw some think pieces on Rory this week, you know, as we're kind of heading towards the playoffs, there's always a drama of like, is he going to play Memphis or not? And, you know, comments he made on the back end of the Open Championship where he effectively said, hey, like, I just don't feel as much juice right now for the PGA Tour. 6-time major winner, completed the career Grand Slam. His priorities are going to be that, playing in a number of national opens, then probably spending a lot of time with his wife and daughter. You know, like, it's important time to be a dad, you know, as Poppy grows up. And I think that's one of the things we love the most about Tony Finau, and the reason why we root for him is like he and Lena and their kids are always having fun together on the road. And I wonder if it's like, you know, Tony Finau's had won multiple times on tour, put together a pretty solid career. You're 36 years old. Your plus skill was that distance, that speed. You get to a certain point. I'm not saying he's not competitive anymore, but it's like, all right, I just might, my priorities of life might change a little bit at this stage.
Well, playing professional golf is not easy, especially with the amount of weeks that is required for most players. You know, some guys have to play every single time they can get a tee time. It's nice to have that luxury like Rory has to where, you know, he doesn't have to tee it up very much. And even gets some rules bent to where he doesn't have to pay the penalty for whatever that is, which is nice. It's good for him.
That's good.
But it's, you know, Keegan would be the guy though to look out for this week. You know, I think he's played well at the Wyndham Championship by my recollection. Mm-hmm. I think he's had some really nice weeks there. Johnny Kiefer, another player that's right there. Jason Day,
or something like that. Do I have that right?
Yeah. They're all right there. So it's going to be interesting, but that man at number 70 is going to be the one that's talked about the most.
That's the next place we're going. Although I really, now that you got me, I want to look at Keegan's course history here. If I could type properly, here we go. let's see. We got maybe not as good as I thought. He
really
missed a cut last year. Tied for 22nd, 24, and then tied 46th, tied for 42nd.
Never mind. Right, I feel like maybe in that 26 year he was got off to a decent start or something because I.
Yeah,
I don't know. I have memories of him.
Like I had the same thing. Decent. That's strange. I don't know why. Yeah.
But you know, okay. So you know who has played well here?
Who's that?
Jackson Coivin,
and he is the 70th man
T5.
On the current FedEx Cup point standings. Would make it to the playoffs. So this is our outside the top 50 list that would not have guaranteed entry into all 2027 signature events. So for most of these names you're reading, you're like, oh, it's kind of a bummer for them. For Jackson Coivin and his limited amount of his third pro start, I guess it was. I think I have that right. Third or fourth pro start,
yeah.
Wins and is 70th on that list, which is pretty amazing. Aldrich Pottgieter, 65th. Shane Lowry, 60th. Jordan Spieth, 55th. Pearson Cootie, 53rd. And Max Homa, 51st. All needing a you know, obviously they have time. Like if they play well this week, whether or not they're teeing it up, should make it into the playoffs, but then need a big week, a TPC Southwind to make it to the BMW Championship and get their signature event guarantee for 2027.
No, there's a ton of names in that 50 to 70 category that are piquing my interest in who's going to try to give themselves some breathing room heading into Memphis. You know, who can have that big week? You know, can Jackson Coivin go out and finish a runner up? And right now, if he got 300 points at runner up, that would get him inside that top 50. A win obviously would vault him up very high where he's going to be, you know, knocking on the door of the Tour Championship, which is, you know what, I feel like if Jackson makes the Tour Championship, he's going to be on the President's Cup team. Like, there's no doubt in my mind. You know, just starting to accumulate points after the college season and making the Tour Championship, there's no world in which he's not on that team. So let's not even talk about it. Like, that's a done deal if he makes it to Atlanta.
Well, and I feel like you were on this so early. You were on this in April. Right. When I spit taked on the show, like if he wins twice, like on which tour are you talking about? Like the PGA Tour, the one we talk about every week. And everyone jumped into this debate this last week after his win at 3M. Brant Snedeker, U.S., of course, the U.S. President's Cup captain, went on SiriusXM PGA Tour radio and they asked him about it. Of course, he said, I'd be dumb to not take a really good, hard look at Coivin from Medina this year. I'm not going to discredit a 21-year-old kid who's played in four or five events this year just because he's been in college. He goes out and plays great golf the next four or five weeks, earns a spot, and shows he's willing to be one of the 12 best players for us. I'd be dumb not to. So that's a confirmation of your same set of beliefs, Smiley.
It is, and I think he would be such a great asset. I mean, there's a bunch of guys, man, that have had awesome years, and you know, we're going to continue to talk a lot about the President's Cup and who should be on this team, who shouldn't. But I think for right now, let's let these guys go tee it up. Let's see who's in form, who's been playing well, and at the end of this, I think we're going to we'll probably be leaning a little bit more into who's played well over the last 12 months versus who's played well maybe in the the past decade. I'd rather look at who's hot, who's playing well, who's got who's earned their way on their team. And I think there's plenty of guys that have done enough now to be in the conversation, but they got to keep going. Like Ryan Gerard, 16th in the FedEx Cup. That is a banner year for him. Like, this is a breakout season. But it's just got him into the conversation. Now he's got to go and prove it even more. And that's a tough thing to swallow as a player, but you just have to do it. You have to keep pushing through. You can't tell yourself that you've done enough to make the team, because it's not enough, especially when you've never been picked for a team. So it's I know we just kind of made an excuse for Koivun and the fact that it's a different set of circumstances, but for regular tour pros, like a guy like Gerard, who, I'd want to see him on the team. Like, he's just got to keep going. He's got to keep, keep on putting big finishes together.
I can't wait to drive you nuts, man. I broke out all my shirts from the 2024 care package with another one on the way to dust off the assistant to the captain bit that we had going the last President's Cup. It's going to be good, man. I'm leaning all the way in this year with thoughts, opinions. Maybe we'll get Jackson to play the assistant to the international captain. If we can make that happen. It's certainly going to heat up. There are a lot of good names in the mix. And like, how about another one? How about Michael Thorbjørnsen? Like, throw his name in the mix. There's a whole bunch of guys you can take a look at.
He's now played his way into the conversation, right?
Yep.
Before he wasn't in the conversation. Now he's dead set on, a guy that we're going to be talking about because he's won. And now he's in a place that he's in a good spot in the FedEx Cup. And if he makes the tour championship, has a big Atlanta, which I imagine that's going to be a great golf course for him. Xander Schauffele's played really well there. I kind of think Xander Schauffele and his game remind me a lot of each other. Both hit high draws.
Yeah. Hey, who designed East Lake? Oh, Donald Ross. Oh, they just updated a couple years ago. And it's played great just this week at a Don Ross place that just got updated this year. I like that one from Michael Thorbjørnsen.
Does he? I'm trying to think. Does East Lake have any cross creeks? I'm thinking of. I don't think so.
No cross creeks there. Thankfully.
Are you kind of second guessing this Hope Valley 11th hole deal?
It's actually going to drive me nuts. Yeah, because I already have enough. Like,
were you team no creek, or were you team add the creek?
I am team. Like, do whatever is most comforting for my mental sanity off the tee. So, like, I'm already standing on 11 tee, especially when we're playing back, and we've got the road, like Dover Road, I think it is, and OB right, and also these two giant trees where if you push it a little bit, like, you don't know if you're going to get, like, the speed slot kick underneath, or it's going to kick straight out and, like, bounce off someone's car. But then on the left, we have this big creek that, like, slowly meanders left to right. And if you're a tee up for like a lot of the tournaments we play and you hit it too good, you get a kick off like some hard pan where there's a bunch of trees over and the grass isn't growing, you're in the creek on that side. So these are all the things I think about every time I tee it up there. What better way to add to my mental anxiety and burden than if you put a creek across the middle of it? I mean, effectively what's going to happen is I'm just going to hit like 4-iron or 2-iron every time and then just hit that same club again to the green. So look forward to that greatly in 2028. On the topic of 2028, actually, there are a few kind of other, as we talk about the players that are in those 50, 70, 100 positions and where they would be in the structure of the new Championship Challenger Series in 2028, there also has been additional reporting on new sponsors, new events, purse sizes in the last week. I think it's worth touching on as we kind of move out of that section. So Sompo, a Japanese insurance company, they're going to take over what was formerly the Pro Court Championship, the event in Napa, for just like a one-year placeholder deal. It's going to be a full field event in July 2027, and then they're going to be one of the 15 event like championship series. So 15 of those events, not including the four majors and the playoffs and the players, and that's how you get to the 23 to 24 event number that Brian Rolapp's discussed a number of times. And so that event that they'll be sponsoring in 2028 will either be in San Francisco, Seattle, or Denver. So interesting news there. I also thought it was interesting seeing Golf Channel's Rex Hoggard this past week talk about the rumored per championship purse numbers, which he's heard is between $33 million to $37 million. And in his report, he called the tournament director, and the response he got when he gave him that number was woof. So, Smiley, I think you and I, we've talked about this on the show. We've said basically Liv was a competitor in this space, and they contributed to a lot of the elevation of money in the game, purse sizes, all guaranteed money for these guys. And I think it was your belief, and really we shared it, that with the kind of decline and removal of Liv in a lot of ways, maybe those purse sizes come back down to, you know, more sustainable levels. $33 million to $37 million, that feels like it's going the other direction.
Well, I mean, if they're able to get it, that's it's impressive, man. You got to give the PGA Tour a ton of credit, like their sales team and just the way in which they're selling this championship series and how series, I should say, the championship league, and how it's going to elevate the product beyond where it's been over the last several decades and post Tiger era, right? Like they've gone to a point now where we haven't had a Tiger Woods playing, and you know, once the last time it felt like Tiger was really playing, 1920, right around there. So we're five, 6 years removed from like Tiger playing consistently on the PGA Tour. Now we've had a star in Scottie Scheffler that has come on the scene and is definitely drawn crowds like you wouldn't believe. I've seen it firsthand, and it's growing every single week. But we've had more and more stars. You've had Netflix. You've had a bunch of different avenues in which fans have gotten more engaged into the game. The game has never been more popular. And I think companies want to be involved in the game of golf when it comes to a marketing and sales standpoint. You're reaching the demographic a lot of times that these companies are wanting to have their clientele with. And now is it worth that number at $33 million, like you said? Like that's a big chunk of I imagine what their budget would be for a lot of places. Now these are big type corporations that have $100 million marketing budgets, I imagine, but still to put a huge chunk towards just a one PGA Tour event that could have weather problems or Rory McIlroy might not show up or whatever it might be, to where, you know, you think you're getting all of the best players there. And theoretically you are. Now, we don't know what we're going to run into because we're not there yet. You know, we don't know what the problems are yet, but you would have to think, you know, if there's 20 of these events, I know we're going to have four majors, you have the players and then the playoff events, you would think that most of the time, all of these guys are going to show up and that it's going to be elevated and bigger crowds, bigger places. Now, that's all still to be determined based on where we go, but it's a big price tag. I don't know what your thoughts are, if you kind of agree with that whole sentiment.
I mean, I think that it's you're making a big bet. And I understand why you're making it, because you're coming in and talking about transforming, you know, not only the competitive structure of the league, but just the whole business model, really, and saying, hey, we need to create more scarcity, or at least, you know,
do you think stratify there's leverage? It. Do you think there was leverage? Like, do you think there's that much demand to be a
that's what I think you're gonna find out pretty dang quick. Is there that much demand? You know, and I think it really, you know, I think the bet you're making is if we have less marquee events, which, by the way, this is something you and I talked about for the 3 years since we've started this show, basically, is like there needs to be the Platinum Tour and the regular tour, and that's effectively become the Championship and the Challenger. It's like, okay, now you're really telling us that, okay, you have the Players Championship and you have the playoffs, like they don't own the majors, but like you have 15 of these events that are 120 player fields, and it's going to be all of our best guys for the most part, plus the players, plus 2 to 3 playoff events. Like those are real scarce assets that's going to be the best version of the PGA Tour on a year-to-year basis. So in that, you're hoping that that upticks interest. Like I think that there another interesting thing that I saw this last week, you know, I don't know if I necessarily agree with it, but just think pieces written about how in the wake of Jackson Koivin's win at the 3M, immediately the conversation focused on the President's Cup, not on impact for the rest of the PGA Tour season or impact on playoffs. And that was kind of like a subhead. And I think there's something to that. It's like you've gotten to a point where, of course, the event serves a purpose. People are going to watch on a week in, week out basis, but there's less of a care about what it actually means in the sense of that competitive structure. So by restructuring these things, the entire, you know, format into the stratifying into the top tier and the second tier, and making each of those one have a ton of value, then maybe you're coming out of, you know, championship event 13. And even if there is a Ryder Cup later that fall, you know, you're talking about the next two or three or four events you're going to see for the rest of the season, because they all matter a ton for the PGA Tour. So I think that's one. I think two is where they go for these markets. If they're going to big markets, like, is that resulting in good on-site fan support, but also support from businesses that headquarter out of those places? You know what I mean? Like, can you get the equivalent support of like a Coca-Cola in Atlanta for East Lake, that, you know, whether that's in Denver or Seattle or San Francisco, some of the places we mentioned for, you know, Sampo coming in, but any sponsor, any major market. And I think that that's one where I'm a little iffy on it. Like, I think that you look at the Cadillac Championship, what they did really well is go get a big ticket sponsor in there, one that wants to step up to the plate and pay like a, you know, a big fee to sponsor that event. And you know, that's you solve the marketing piece there. But you look at the on-site support and sort of fan engagement, the way it presents on TV, and you're like, man, you know, I don't know what, if you're trying to,
like, is the check worth?
Is the check worth
what, like, we're watching as a viewer?
Because you're, you know, I'm sure that there are a ton of different goals for any sort of marketing director, you know, putting a spin together. Like, obviously a lot of them are, hey, we have hospitality on site, so we can bring like our clients here. We can make this some sort of perk. But there's also like, you're putting your name on something that is publicly presented for four straight days on television, on social platforms. And if people are taking screenshots saying, look, there's nobody here at the Cadillac Championship, it's like, huh, I don't know if I like being associated with that. And I think the third thing that I think about is that venues matter. You know, that like there are places that are, you know, like people, like some Riviera, people argue.
That's going to be a big one, man. Like the fact that we're not going to be going back there.
Or like, you know, even like small markets where, you know, you argue about whether or not Hilton Head should support an elevated tour event, you know, but Harbortown's such a good venue. Like, so it's interesting and intriguing. Like
I'm not saying it's the heart and soul of the PGA Tour, but like that's the type of event that has just been, you know, on the PGA Tour for forever. Like, same with Colonial. Like, that is, there's so much history at Colonial. I remember walking on that first tee thinking, like, seeing the names on the wall, just like, man, this is so cool to be a part of this event. And the fact that it's being debated as like possibly not being an elite event. I'm like, what are we doing here? Like, this place is historic.
Well, and I get why that there are, you know, things at play there that are, you know, related to, you know, economic and business factors that are beyond the intelligence base that this podcast has. You know, there are a lot smarter people out there that can afford that. But I do think that it's, you know, you're if you're talking about,
it's coming down to money together, though. Like, you're talking about money.
Yeah. Which, you're asking a sponsor like, hey, come to this smaller event in this smaller market, but still pay $33-37 million because, you know, because it's the heart and soul of the PGA Tour, because we really like the course. I can understand why there's some hesitation from that person as to whether or not they want to cut the check. But then
someone's got to make a sacrifice. So for the fans that want to see these places, or even listening to the players, they're like, if we're going to golf courses that we don't want to play, that we have no history with, and there's no relationship with this city or just the people there, you know, like, there's something cool about going to the same place every single year, and you meet this, you know, so many different people, go to the same restaurants. And I can certainly say that for somebody who's traveled the PGA Tour the last decade. Like, I there's some places that I've really, really enjoyed to go and visit and like to, you know, whether it's, you know, going to the zoo in Columbus, for instance, like doing all the things like with families that and San Antonio is like one of the best events of the year for families. And that doesn't seem like it's going to be an event that makes it to the next one. So there's just, I don't know, there's that aspect.
I think too that like to wrap up the whole set of thoughts on it is effectively that I just don't know that what they're replacing it with, even though someone might be reluctant to spend on a small market and a course size character, I don't know that the other version is necessarily going to sell better. You know, I think that's what it boils down to, is like, I understand why in theory, if you're telling me there are less events and they're in bigger markets, you know, that those should sell, like, in theory they should. I just don't know if they actually will. We'll find out pretty quickly.
No, you would definitely will. They're coming across strong. And
yeah,
I think when you have something that's new that they're excited about, that the players are behind, and that it's easy for players, fans, and everybody to understand, and it's less guys, you got the top players, and all of that makes sense. The one thing I wanted to add to something mm-hmm. that I think the PGA Tour should lean heavily on, especially when 2028 gets here for the championship series. I don't know what keep on calling the championship series. It kind of rolls off the tongue.
Well, I think it's, I don't, I mean, yeah, like I'm is a championship track, or like, what are we supposed to call this? We need talking points on this.
Anyways, so just think about this, Charlie. So you got 100 players, and I would say that there was, or maybe if at times it'll be closer to 120. Is that right? Like what they expect to have playing week in and week out. Mm-hmm. Is it around 120 or so?
Yeah. Yeah. Like that's average fields of 120 is kind of the line they've used.
I would say that in a typical PGA Tour season, let's even take out the years that haven't been the signature events that have kind of like made everything you're either one side or the other as far as like which events you're getting into. In the past, you know, you had guys playing certain events that they wanted to play and that suited their schedule. So you yep. would have, you know, let's say Scottie Scheffler in one bucket who liked to play, you know, this set of golf tournaments. Like, let's say he liked to play the Florida Swing. Xander Schauffele, on the hand, he didn't like to play the Florida Swing. I'm just using these guys as examples. But you typically or at times wouldn't get the best players playing against each other often. And that's, you know, ultimately how we ended up in the signature event stuff that was to try to, you know, compete against LIV. And now we're kind of finding the best of both. And so what I'm telling you now, which I think the PGA Tour should lean into, is that there's a big reason why I watch NFL football, which I only watch it because of fantasy. That is the only reason I watch it. And at times because of the quarterbacks, just maybe the stories of, you know, a Joe Burrow who went to LSU. I'll watch maybe the LSU guys, but I think the PGA Tour has a huge opportunity, especially mm-hmm. with what we've seen in gambling in the game of golf and the interest and in how people consume the game of golf. Now, when they watch, it's, you know, they have a one and done pick, right? Mm-hmm. Like they have mm-hmm. something that they are tied to for that week. I think with less players and 120 guys, and they're going to be playing the same place every single week, I think fantasy golf could explode. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be a huge driver for the PGA Tour to get more people to tune in to their streaming, to looking at their apps, to watching network coverage, and ultimately following these players more. Because if you have 10 guys on your team for the entire year that you drafted with a group of 12 guys, it's like, all right, these are my guys, and I'm going to cheer for them when it's got going well. And, you know, I understood this as a professional golfer. I got hate when I played bad. I
was about to say, and RIP to all of their social media reply feeds.
Just think about like what has happened yeah. with fantasy football and how there's
a great point.
Trips that are planned throughout. You know, this is the one trip I have. It's like it's a guy's golf trip. We're going to do a fantasy football draft, and yep. the loser's going to have to do a punishment. And it's a thing, right? Like this is something that every now and even like it's not just guys anymore. Like there's the mother. It's like a family leagues, and then it's a work league, and everybody's got this league that they're yeah. in. And it wasn't always this way. Right. But people understand fantasy football now. They need to do this in fantasy golf for the PGA Tour. And now that it's a simple, easy to understand and have a lot of players that are playing against each other week in and week out, I think it's be way, way more easy in versus like, you know, the Xander and the Scotty mm-hmm. thing where they're just not mm-hmm. playing the same events.
I think it's a great idea and a great point. And I think for me, it feels like it has a little bit of a, which you kind of mentioned in the context of like families and work leagues, it has a little bit of a softer edge than maybe straight up gambling does, you know, like, you know, outright wins on a player, top 20s, you know, I think
it feels less gambly, right?
It's less,
that's even a word.
Less to use a colloquial term, it's less gambly, but it is, you know, I think that's where we kind of start to veer into the lane and heard from players that talk about impacts, you know, potential outcomes being impacted, you know, guys yelling, you know, when they miss a putt or, you know, telling a tee shot to go get in a bunker, things like that, where there is a more a softer but a fun edge to a fantasy team where you could still throw, you know, $50 on a league for a season. I mean, I laugh about that sometimes, like my fantasy football team or fantasy Premier League teams, where I'm like so invested on a week to week basis. Like, buddy, you threw down $50 in August. Like, this doesn't matter at all. Like, the league winner gets like a half this, a 10 team. Like, there's nothing that, but it's just you have an investment in the team and the guys on your team. And it's become a fun sort of ritual, to your point. Like, you're trying to get fans to develop rituals they can go back to throughout the season. And so I think exactly what you said, it should be a 10-player roster. Like, there are applications from Daily Fantasy and golf, you know, where you can do teams for a tournament or teams for a day, where it's like you have a salary cap of, you know, 50,000 fake dollars and you plug in six players and they all have like a weekly adjusted, you know, value. We used to draft these guys, you know, just put together teams in this sort of fashion. It's like, do that, but, you know, have it just be a proper – like, you don't need to have a salary cap for it unless you're playing in like some league that has a fancy budget.
It's the same
just
thing.
Draft like 10 guys. If they get injured, you drop them on the waivers. You put them on the IR. You pick up Jackson Coivin when he turns pro. Like, that waiver wire claim is going to be amazing. It gives you a season long thread. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, well, that too. Like, and then you're playing your buddy that week who's got, yeah, you know, the guys who are playing the worst. And you're like, oh, I'm going up against these guys this week. And then they all show up and play really well. And you're like,
yeah,
this is unbelievable. And it's why fantasy football is so totally annoying agree. At times, because you have a great team and you could be scoring the most points in the league, but all of a sudden you're, you know, potentially close to last, which we actually developed a rule in our league that if you score the most points and you don't make the playoffs, that you get the last spot in the playoffs, which is it's a great rule.
I tell you what, can you imagine on the topic of, like, you know, you're talking about buddy trips for fantasy football, you know, they reconfigured the schedule in 2028 season opener for the WM Scottsdale buddies trip. In the bleachers on 16, drafting your team on like a Tuesday, watching guys hit shots. And I mean, a few things on earth would be more electric than that.
Week to week matchups sound fun to me. Like, I would love to be in a league where, you know, and especially too, like, I remember talking to Josh Allen at American Century Championship, and I was like talking about fantasy football, and he's like, he was talking about how he had a league. Like, these guys are allowed in the NFL to have leagues, and you could see PGA Tour players also doing the same and having their own team and drafting guys, and you're getting in the locker room and being like, hey, nice play today, you know, a-hole.
can you imagine, like, you know, JT and Jordan playing in a group together, and, like, you know, JT is you know, playing against a team that has Jordan on that week, and, like, he just finishes everything out as fast as he can to, like, leave the gallery's moving while Jordan's trying to putt. Like, all sorts of shenanigans would go on out there. It'd be a lot of fun. But yeah, I mean, there is a way to make it softer than real gambling, which I do kind of think it is what golf needs in a way, just because we kind of started to tiptoe up to that line where it's like, it's a little uncomfortable in certain scenarios. That would, and in terms of an audience expansion perspective, you know, you bring in casuals in a way that you really haven't prior to this, because, you know, on a week to week basis, it's hard. Golf betting's hard, you know, like, you show up and you're like, I'm just going to put out a bunch of money on different guys to win outright. It's like, okay, you might have just burned through a couple $100 and none of them won. Like, good luck next week. Like, that. Well, like, so, yeah.
If the PGA Tour is not going to do it, we're going to develop our own.
We're developing. I like it. That, hold us to that.
See, now we got the leverage.
Now we get the leverage.
Hey, you want the good news or the bad news?
You can. Let's go bad news first.
Bad news is we're pushing Liv to next week. We did it again. Good news is we're wrapping. We got Sweeney. Are we throwing to Sweeney?
Well, that is so good because I was about to do like the trademark move on the show, which is like live production. I don't know where you're watching this, where you're listening to this. Like, I don't know what my dismount's going to be. Like, either one of a number of things is going to happen. Either this is the end of this episode, in which case, thanks so much for watching and listening, or we're going right now to Stephen Sweeney to talk to you about all the putting work he's done with Michael Thorbjørnsen, or that video or clip is going to drop tomorrow on podcast and video feeds. It's sort of a choose your own adventure, except we've already chosen it for you, but I want to kind of feel like you have some ownership in this process, viewer and or listener of the Smiley Show. So that's all we got. We'll eventually talk about this whole lift thing.
We have more, but we just didn't get to it.
we have, you know what? You do 30 minutes on things you like or dislike about golf architecture and caddies, you start burning through the total runtime pretty quickly. So I say let's chalk it up to a good conversation that I hope many of you enjoyed. And we'll get to everything. Honestly, it's just another week of news to break about LIV.
Honestly, I really feel like after LIV Bedminster, which is next week, there's just going to be so much that comes out. And like, there's going to be a lot of interviews, a lot of guys that have quotes, and we will have 3 weeks of data from all of this LIV stuff that we will then confidently be able to hopefully not guess and be able to give you what our opinions are.
It was a carefully planned production decision. That was a great spin, Smiley. Yeah, we want to give you the fully versed opinion. So just wait on us for that. So there you go. Whatever comes next, hope you enjoy it. We'll talk to you back here pretty soon, I guess. See ya.
See ya.
We'll see you next week on the Golf Channel. This has been The Smiley Show.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our lovely fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too, so please keep it up.
For all the good people on YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the...